Calling all lovers of mystery and fans of a good story. If you haven't already heard me talk about June's journey, you're in for a treat. It's time to don your detective hat in this free hidden object mobile game that delves into the captivating journey of June Parker, a self-proclaimed detective on a quest to unravel the mystery surrounding her sister's untimely death. In June's journey, you get to play as June, deciphering clues and unveiling secret plots within thousands of beautifully illustrated scenes. And did I mention it's set in the glitzy 1920s? New chapters are added weekly, so you will never run out of new thrills to uncover, and you can also personalize and decorate your very own Orchid Island where the story takes place. How sharp are your detective skills? Find out when you download June's Journey on your Android or iOS device, or play online via Facebook Games. Your detective journey awaits.
Are you thinking about getting into Dungeons & Dragons? Maybe you're looking to expand your horizons as a DM or a player. If that's the case, then it's time for you to check out The Dungeon Cast, the best D&D podcast out there that helps you passively learn all about the game just by listening. Join co-hosts Will and Brian as they break down the lore of a rich multiverse 50 years in the making in a lighthearted and beginner-friendly way. They cover everything from character creation options to tips for dungeon masters. There's something for everyone, no matter how long you've been playing TTRPGs. Find The Dungeon Cast anywhere you get podcasts or on YouTube.
From Film Nation Entertainment, this is Hypothetical, the show where what-ifs become now-whats. I'm your host, Carrie Bechet. In our first episode, Mind Over Matter, we asked, what if we could read minds? Well, we're excited to share an extended bonus interview with our featured scientist, Dr. House. No, not that Dr. House. Dr. Patrick House is a neuroscientist and science writer who has spent over a decade researching mind control parasites. If you're wondering what the heck a mind control parasite is, then you're not alone, and you must keep listening. In this conversation, I dig deeper with Dr. House on philosophy, the inner workings of the brain, and how mind control might one day become an actual reality. We discuss the taste of strawberries, the color of your imagination, and Dr. House reveals his surprising nightmare scenario about the dystopian future of mind-reading technology. Now, make sure those earbuds are nestled right up next to the auditory cortex in your temporal lobe, and here we go. My conversation with Dr. Patrick House. When did you first get started? How did you know that this was what you wanted to study? How did brain science become the thing?
I started as a philosopher, or at least that might be too strong of a term, at least interested in philosophy and philosophy of mind. And the things I cared about were things like free will and the basic kind of like unanswered philosophical questions of the last couple hundred years. If you have a brain in a vat, how do we speak about a brain sitting in a vat? What kind of experiences does that thing have? And as I was kind of sitting in these seminar rooms, having conversations about these things, reading old philosophy texts about these questions, I realized that kind of modern neuroscience had caught up to a lot of these questions, and that you could take a mouse brain, put it in a vat, and actually keep it alive for a long, long time by bathing it in these like salty fluids and actually answer these questions.
So what is the idea just philosophically? Why would you discuss, philosophically speaking, a brain in a vat? Is it the idea of just like the neutral state of the thing?
So you kind of want to strip away the things that are inessential to get at whatever's left. And if you remove, and it almost sounds morbid when I put it like this, but kind of remove appendage by appendage and piece by piece a body until you're left with only a brain, you kind of want to know what are the necessary parts.
I see.
For kind of a brain to operate.
You're reducing the variables.
You're reducing as much as you can. And it kind of, once you reach the limit and you cannot reduce any further, hypothetically, you're somewhere around the truth, or maybe, right? And so that, I think that's the fun part about those types of thought experiments.
Can you define for me a philosophy of mind?
I tend to be very broad in my terms. I think it's just inquiry. I mean, I think genuinely when a person is having an argument with their spouse and they question why they did the thing that they did or why they said the thing that they said and didn't know the reason for it, they are engaging in philosophy of mind just as much as someone who's sitting in a room talking about a mouse brain in a disembodied vat. I mean, it's just one of the kind of last things to understand. And there's a really big distance between how closely we know what it is to be ourselves and alive and conscious and what our brains do. But we're so actually distanced from it. We don't know how much it weighs, right? Your brain is sitting in your skull right now. Mine's sitting in mine. But I don't know how much it weighs, right? It just feels like this kind of, it doesn't even feel like anything, right? And so it's got this weird ability to be almost as close as you can by definition get to what it is to be you, but actually be just so far removed that we don't even have the right like kind of words to define it. We don't know how. Usually, most people, I happen to know how heavy a human brain is, but most people don't know how heavy a human brain is.
And, how heavy is the human brain?
Coincidentally, about like, have you ever held a hardback copy of Infinite Jest? It's about 3 pounds. Coincidentally.
I heard he planned that, actually.
Yeah, he must have. So I was at Stanford for about a decade, and there's a class, I helped teach a class called Literature in the Brain, and we had a guest lecturer, one of the top neuroscientists in the world, really, one of the co-chairs of President Obama's Brain Initiative, came in. And the first thing he said was, there's a basic unanswered question about the brain, which is, why is it the case that we look at one chunk of brain tissue, and if you activate that somehow, it creates the subjective sensation of seeing something. And if you activate one a little bit over, that looks identical, as far as we can tell, looks identical. That creates the sense of hearing, the subjective sense of hearing. And just, we don't know the answer to that basic question. If you show someone a face in a, they're sitting in the kind of sarcophagus-like tomb of an fMRI scanner, and you show them a human face, activity in some part of their brain, which is correlated with neural activity, will show up in the face area of their brain. Right? That's what we know.
We've got a face area of our brain.
Yeah. Well, that's what I mean is like, to me, these are the Ptolemaic astronomers looking up and saying, we know where things are. We know that if you show someone a face, it will activate a neural activity or a good proxy for neural activity in the face area. But we don't know why, right? It's possible that we're making some assumptions that will be overturned, which is to answer your question of what don't we know. But we just have to do our best.
So if there were a way to kind of get inside people's heads, what would that ultimately look like? If it's not pictures, what might we be able to kind of access that's going on in people's brains? Like, I've heard about science that can predict whether someone is going to choose left or right before the person decides to do it.
If there was a common thread to the things I've been interested in my whole life, I do think something like that moment of decision where someone chooses left or right, where a mouse in an experimental setup chooses left or right, and on the left is a cat and on the right is not a cat. They're choosing. And the thing that we most care about as social primates, as people like to understand the world and understand ourselves is like, do we have enough information to give a good guess about what someone might do? That's all we really care about. And the whole reason I went off and did a PhD in this kind of mind control parasite was because what interested me was this parasite gets into a mouse brain, and the story at the time was that it kind of changes the preferences. So my mice are canonically afraid of cats. This is a standard thing, right? It's a Tom and Jerry thing. And what this parasite did, which it could only reproduce in a cat, it could only sexually reproduce in a cat, so it got into a mouse brain. And evolutionarily, it had to get back to another cat. That's its life cycle need. And so it gets into a mouse brain. And the idea was that it was getting in there, maybe targeting the part of the mouse that was afraid of a cat, mucking something up, and then making that mouse, therefore, choose differently and actually choose to maybe go investigate the smell of the cat or choose to be closer to the cat. Do something where it's kind of perturbing a preference. And so to me, that's the end-all question of philosophy of mind and neuroscience. Like, can you get in there? Can you get in that brain with whatever resolution or tools that you have available to you and show where that choice is? Like, and somehow understand the way which that little mouse is choosing to go left or right.
If we could look in a brain, we'd see a lot of different possibilities for possible actions or future plans a person could take. I think there's also this idea that if we could read someone's mind, we could also have a sense of possibly like what they really mean, that there's some sort of interior, like we could get at the truth of what they're maybe not expressing or not saying.
I go back, I know like things like Black Mirror are all the vogue. And I'm more of a fan, OG Twilight Zone, and they've been thinking about these things for a very long time. People have been thinking about what will happen when we have access to someone else's thoughts for a very, very long time. And there's an episode I love called A Penny for Your Thoughts, which is this old episode where a guy flips a coin and it lands on its edge. Like if we flip this coaster, right? And it landed on its edge, it's improbable. Some magic realism happens and he can read thoughts for 24 hours. And he works at a bank. So I don't know why he goes to work, but he goes to work, you know, 30-minute episode. You got 20 minutes of filler in there where he's going around listening to like someone's having an affair, someone's about to leave their partner, someone's mind is empty. But he can go in and he can kind of like get close to someone and listen in on their inner monologue. And he goes to the back. He works at a bank and there's a 70-year-old security guard and he gets close to him, listens in on his thoughts. And the security guard is thinking, okay, at 4:30 p.m., the manager will leave the key on the desk and I'll go in and I'll open the drawer and I'll grab it at 4:36. I'll open the vault at 4:38. I'll take the bag of money. My wife will meet me outside at 4:42 and then I'll take off.
He's going to rob the bank.
The guy, morally unsure of what to do, calls the cops and says, hey, look, the security guard's going to rob the bank. I have it on good evidence that this guy's going to rob the bank. Here's his plan. And the cops show up and they say, hey, you know, here's your plan. We know what you're planning. Here's the exact breakdown, minute by minute. And they try to arrest him. And he's like, you know, I've been working here for 40 years. I plan on robbing the bank. This is what I do every day. This is how I daydream. Every day I plan on robbing the bank. I'm never going to do it, but every day I plan on robbing the bank. And I think that is like the only story that matters about this type of technology for like all of the 20th century, if you had to pick one story. It's that, because it gets across immediately the idea that on an interpersonal level, on a social level, on a legal level, on a moral level, we don't know how to deal with the encroachment into someone else's thoughts. Like, we don't know what to do with it. And we also don't know what to do with the context of planning and knowing the difference between a planned action and actually engaging.
So it seems like even if we could get to a point where we've developed a technology where we can effectively read the inner monologue, if not the pictures and impressions, but at least the verbal expression of the thoughts of people, we would really be at a loss of being able to interpret what those might even mean.
I think so. I don't know how to accurately interpret, intention matters in the court of law today, and it matters greatly. If it were possible for that feed to somehow include this meta layer that says, oh, well, here's a planned but will not engage in action versus one that will, you know, you kind of have to then also, this is what I mean by thoughts are not just pictures or podcast streams. You have to also then understand who he is, who he wants to be. He's not the type of person to engage in that type of behavior. Like, how do you just kind of like tag his thoughts as unlikely to occur? I think this matters to a lot of people in the context of lying. But when I hear that, I think, okay, imagine there's a teenage girl, I think she was like 13 or 14. This was in the early 90s. And she was undergoing a neurosurgery. And she had epilepsy in one part of her brain, and they knew where it was, and they were going to go in and take out that part of her brain to stop the epilepsy. And her brain is open. Brain doesn't feel pain, right? This is that whole weightless thing. We don't know really what it is. The brain does not feel pain. It kind of processes pain, but it in and of itself, if you like push it, kind of has the soft cheese kind of consistency or like pushback, but it does not itself feel pain. And so they do the neurosurgery with her awake and with her speaking, because they kind of probe their electrode around the brain and want to make sure to miss the kind of important parts of the brain, which I've always thought was funny, because they actually sometimes if it's a singer, they'll have them sing during the surgery. If they're a musician, they'll have them play music just to make sure, like, if they stop being able to play, they'll be like, okay, avoid that. If they stop being able to speak, they'll be like, okay, the surgeon is like, okay, this is where language happens. We avoid that. But what I think is funny is they don't have them say, write a poem. And then when the poem gets really shitty, say, okay, let's keep that, right? We don't, we can understand on a crude level speaking and not speaking, but we can't understand on a deeper level, like good at something, not good at something. And so she's sitting there, she's speaking. The doctor is probing around her brain with an electrode and stimulates a part of her brain that makes her laugh. She laughs. I think a nurse or a doctor asks, why did you laugh? So the real answer is the stimulating electrode caused my motor cortex to cascade neural activity down to my throat to generate air molecules that, when released, was perceived by those in the room as the sound of laughter, right? That's the real reason. But she says the painting on the wall is funny. And they do it again, and she says the doctor just told a joke. But there was no funny painting on the wall. The doctor did not just tell a joke, right? Her brain, in the absence of knowing what to do, knew that it laughed. That's what it knows. It knew that it laughed for some reason, but it didn't know why. And it, rather than admit that you do anything for no reason, it filled in a reason. And so my question to you then is, let's say you have whatever technological version of mind control device you're imagining. Did she lie? When she answered that question, was she lying?
Great question.
On some level, she doesn't know the right answer and is lying to herself. And so this idea of it being simple to read someone's thoughts or it being simple to ascertain whether or not someone's lying is really hard. And I think we don't realize how little access we have to our own brain's operations.
So it seems unlikely then that it might be used in a criminal justice sort of context or in the way that we have used eyewitness accounts, but we've learned that eyewitness accounts are actually really unreliable in a court of law sort of scenario. Do you think that there's a chance that we would get this technology and maybe use it for those purposes, but maybe use it badly?
So it will obviously be used by the legal system and law enforcement first, probably, though, by overpromising its ability, mostly as an interrogation technique. Right now in China, sometime last year, maybe mid last year, they released these construction helmets that had EEG leads all throughout the helmet to their, you know, state employees and said that these helmets could read thoughts. I would guess that most people don't have the scientific background to necessarily know when that moment will actually happen, where that statement means something. Right now, it means nothing. It's a total fabrication. But effectively, does it matter? Because when they, workers right now, wearing the hats across the world, and they are behaving as if their thoughts are being read. You know, the actual like technical operation of these devices is almost secondary to the way in which it will have to be introduced to the world and the ways in which it will be exploited.
So what is that, you know, you mentioned this, I think this kind of iconic idea we have of I put on a helmet and it somehow interprets my thoughts in whatever way we think that is. I think generally, you're right, people think of it as like, you can hear my inner monologue. Is that what it's going to be if and when we actually develop this technology, in your opinion? Like, am I going to put on a helmet? It's going to read my brainwaves?
There'll be a helmet for sure. And I think it'll probably be some combination of from the inside and from the outside. So,
ooh, from the inside.
What does that mean? some of the coolest stuff people are working on now is, so if you ask a neurosurgeon right now what they hope to get from the researchers that are working on brain machine interfaces and making things smaller and smaller, an honest neurosurgeon would be appalled if they were still doing neurosurgery in 20 years. If they were still opening up the brain, which is an incredibly risky, figuratively Pandora's box of just messiness and mortality.
Well, how are they going to get in there if they don't cut open her head?
Like, so this is the thing is like, and this is actually what frustrates me as a scientist today, kind of knowing some of the things that I know is science fiction has presumed that this is a workable technology for a long time and just kind of skipped ahead to like story and character, which they should do. But for example, Fantastic Voyage, Isaac Asimov's old sci-fi thing where you just shrink people in a little mini submarine and it's kind of, the whole thing is a kind of like Lost World adventure in taking place in the circulatory system. And, you know, they have to wind their way through these tiny little miniature nano people through the heart and the lungs and eventually the brain. Now, if you ask the kind of nanomaterials people that are working on this, which by the way, people in academia are working on this, there's people in the private industry working on this. And then there's government, which is kind of like feeding both of those. Most of these neuroscience companies that are doing that are hoping to achieve this. Facebook is working on this. Google's working on this. There's a few other little ones. And they're hiring nano engineers and optics people. This is a light problem. It's a physics problem. It's a, like, how do you make things small? How do you make little radio transmitters on a nano scale such that you could sit one next to your neurons? You could sit one in different parts of your brain and it would send out a signal to that hat that we're imagining wearing. It'll be something like that. A doctor, hopefully, injects something into you, into your bloodstream, and it navigates and finds its way. Maybe let's imagine hundreds of millions of little, they call them dust now. It's tiny little nano, basically nano sensors, nano robots that will go to various different parts of your brain, and they can listen in on their local environment. They can listen in on what the neurons in their immediate surrounding are doing and kind of relay them together to create an image of what all 80-ish billion neurons in a human brain are doing. Because you have to keep tabs on 80 billion neurons at the same time. That's the goal. So you'd sprinkle a bunch of these little dust, this little nano dust throughout the brain. And then probably just for like energetics and the thickness of the skull is the hardest thing to get through. But you got to send that information out somehow. Even if it can listen in the best nano device in the world, the best little nano radio in the world, it's got to get the information out somehow.
So it's got to transmit.
Yeah. And so that's probably why, for power reasons, you're going to have a helmet sitting on the head that's going to be picking up all of this and kind of interpreting it.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch. And organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/realm.
Contained herein are the heresies of Radolf Buntwine, erstwhile monk turned traveling medical investigator. Join me as I uncover the blasphemous truth of a plague-ridden world, that ours is not a loving God, and we are not its favored children. The Heresies of Radolf Buntwine, coming January 2nd, wherever podcasts are available.
What would life be like if we could, say, for instance, with these helmets and injectable nano neural dust, be able to say, and it, what if we limit it to this idea of the sub-vocalized speech so we can hear the voices in somebody else's head? Like, what would a world, and, you know, I love how confident you are that the thing that people are going to want to use it for is communicating with each other. So what would a world where we have that technology, sort of the way you kind of describe how you think it would most likely happen, what would that look like? How would that feel? What would it be like?
Yeah, so the easiest part of the brain to kind of listen in on is the part that's closest to the skull. It gets like exponentially harder the deeper you get. It just gets more confusing down there. You get more like on a Freudian level, like a little bit more primordial down there. It gets weirder and, you know, it gets like darker kind of the deeper you go. It's like a jungle. But the question is, and we're actually really lucky to have this answer, which is what parts of what it is to be human are on the outer, superficial edges of the brain. And there's two things super useful. That one is in the very back, which is vision. Most of our vision, even our eyes are in the front. Most of the visual processing happens in the back of the brain, the back, like, top part. And the motor output.
So vocal cords.
So everything, are all that we do, all of our little gestures right now. So what that means is that, luckily, one of the easiest kind of, it's almost like if you're mid-19th century, you're prospecting for gold, you go, what's the lowest hanging fruit? What's the thing that's easiest? You don't dig down in the mines, you just take your little pail on the river and pick out the gold nugget. So the gold nugget equivalent for the brain is, luckily, there's a bunch of motor output that we can listen in on. And so what that means is that companies like Facebook and anyone else who has this going on at this moment, this type of research, what they're trying to do is basically make a better keyboard. Milliseconds before you type with your fingers, you plan to type. And so if you can intervene at that step where you don't even need your hands, you can intervene like one step up. You then have a way of kind of typing with your mind. And this is what tech companies want, or like, yeah, I'll just say it. This is what the boring tech companies want. And it's what the government wants, because effectively what you want to be able to do with that is put one of these in my brain under the skull, put one in your brain under the skull. And you and I, even if we're not in the same room, could speak. We'd have to maybe learn a new language. There might be some training process involved, right? Because we wouldn't know how to necessarily interpret each other's thoughts. But you're effectively making a physical connection between that part of my brain and that part of your brain. If it's like on all the time, if it's just an open channel, you and I could talk back and forth all the time. If we just kind of put random numbers on the table and say that my brain is operating, it's doing what it does. Most of what it does is not accessible to me. Let's say that I have access to like 1% of what my brain is actually doing. And this is not like your brain only uses 10% thing, that your brain uses 100% of your cells at all times. But you, as a person, introspectively, only, let's say you have access to 1% of its operations, right? Like, I don't know how it's keeping track of the glass with the eye saccade thing and canceling it all out and filling in all the blanks. And I have no idea how that's all happening. And so I only have access to 1% of my inner brain state. And then when I use language to communicate to you what I'm feeling, think about how many miscommunications and mistakes in the history of man and the history of communication have occurred because of an inability to communicate what you're truly wanting to say or what you're truly feeling to someone. It's a low fidelity technology on some level.
It's interesting to me that you describe language as a technology, and it seems like any technology, it's amoral. It's neither good nor bad. It's just the way you use it. And that this, hypothetical mind-reading technology is similar in that way.
It hurts my soul a little bit to talk about language in that way, but I guess I mean it kind of like a tool. It's a thing.
Yeah.
I don't know where to put the lines of combining man and... I don't want to combine man and machine at all. I think that... I don't care about that at all. I think the goals are to combine man and man, like to get people talking in a... just to... the more ideas get exchanged, the better. That's kind of all I really care about. And I think if you did go back and brought your moral arbiters back to Ice Age Cro-Magnon day and said, hey, we got this technology, it's called language. Do you guys want it? People will have access to your thoughts if you want them to. You'll be able to communicate with them in this neat little one-way channel. And I think a lot of people would say, well, you know, my thoughts are my thoughts and I don't want to communicate them. I don't want to hear other people's thoughts. I don't know what to do with this information. What, it'll be used for bullying. It'll be used, you know, for all kinds of immoral ends. But I don't know, would we go back and like decide that way? And so I don't want to say that this technology is in any way equivalent to like the boon or advent of what language brought us. It's just to me a sliding and hopefully evolving scale of how can we be closer and closer? That's all we want. We tell stories to each other. All of our literature and all of our art are just trying to transmit stories across space and time. All we do with fairy tales is we compress wisdom and try to pass it on to future generations. What if we could just do that a little bit quicker?
It strikes me that what you're describing is more of what we already have. Like, we're going to use this new tool whenever we get it in whatever form it takes, the way we use our old tools to communicate with each other. I wonder if one of the values of that is if we'll have a better, deeper understanding of the way our own and other people's brains work. So maybe we'll be, we keep searching for this really authentic sense of communication. And I think one of the reasons we're so interested in mind reading is we think it's going to give us an even more authentic sense of what another person is thinking or means or intends. And maybe instead what we're going to get is sort of a murkier, more kind of numerous kind of possible way that our brains work. And so maybe it'll nudge us in a direction of looking less for the one authentic truth and sort of understanding kind of like the infinite variation and kind of possibility in our own thoughts and other people's thoughts.
I've heard a lot of people give the answer to what if you could change anything about your brain, would you change? And most people, when they give that answer, do exactly as you said. Kind of just extend the normal and extend what they already know and imagine that being a little bit better. They're like, oh, well, maybe I want more memory or quicker access to memory or something like that. It's a failure of imagination because if you want like a 20% boon in memory, just get better sleep. Like that's available to us. That is not hard. And what you can actually do, we talk about, and it's almost on a simple first pass level, like to put a little thing in my brain, put a little chip on the right under my skull and then put one in your brain and then we'll be able to communicate. But that's actually, that's kind of a way to ease into how this technology might be used, but I don't think by any means it's not nearly spectacular enough. And what I meant by, I think the tech companies that are making the little typing assistants, I call them boring because they're not doing anything about what it is to be human. They're not doing anything about the good stuff. They're just making kind of prosthetic arms, right? If you can just type better, you're just mimicking a hand, not a brain. You're not doing anything neat there. And so instead of putting it one in me and one in you, the cool thing you can do is put one in one part of my brain and then another in another part of my brain within my own case. And we have no idea how brains will react to this. And we have no idea kind of what is possible. So what I mean by that is if you ask what is special about a human brain versus a lot of other animal brains, the very simple answer is we're not made of different stuff. It's all the same cells. It's all the same neurons. It's the way it's arranged. And it's the way that it kind of connects to itself. And we have all these discrete regions and we have like massive connections between all of them. And this we're like a simple way, incorrect on some level, but a simple way to describe a human brain is to say we're like overly connected. We have regions of our brain that do nothing but connect other regions of brains to other regions of brain. Like we have kind of almost like I think of it like the switchboard, the operator switchboard in the 1950s. You know, we have tons of those. And I think, for example, one of the coolest things you could do if you had this technology would be, so remember when I said that the visual system is kind of like processed, your visual stream is kind of processed in the back of your brain. And it's got this hierarchy to it where the photons come in and then they kind of get like fed upwards all these different layers. I call them layers. Let's say there are 10. When I close my eyes and try to imagine anywhere I've ever been, or even if I can close my eyes and try to imagine this very studio, it's immediately like 80s Atari resolution. It's barely in any color. It's really lo-fi. Like I cannot conjure. My memories are just really, my visual memory of something is really poor, right? I don't know. Is yours in color?
Color isn't the first thing that occurs to me.
Yeah.
No.
I have to kind of like remember specifically a color and kind of paste it onto a car that is driving by. But I mean, does it fill in your visual field? Does it feel rich and full like you're in front of an IMAX?
You know what it feels like? It doesn't feel so visual. I feel it more than I see it or think it. When I think about walking into my own home or something, it's not so much that I'm walking around through, you know, they talk about a memory palace as a mnemonic device. I'm not walking around in a very specific memory palace that I've created of my home that I know very well. It's more that I have a sense of a feeling of what it's like to be there, I guess.
But if I asked you kind of questions of visual discrimination, you could say the color of your welcome mat.
Certainly.
Right. One of the neat things about what we know about what is happening in your brain when you're doing that, so when you're closing your eyes and imagining the memory palace idea, is that we're using the same parts of the brain that are helping us see when we have our eyes open. So we're brains are efficiency maniacs, right? So we're using, if there's 10 layers, we're using some of those as we close our eyes and try to imagine these things. But it's not very visually sharp, right? And I think one of the coolest things you could do is take whatever part of the brain is doing the visual imagination part, and like you could connect it up to like an earlier layer or one of the early layers and make it full color and make it so that when you close your eyes, it's not such a huge drop off in the fidelity or like richness of what it is to imagine things. So when people are like, oh, I want to be able to type faster. Oh, I want to be able to remember better. And I'm like, no, you could close your eyes. And when you do, have a rich visual experience, right? Like I do like science writing on the side, and I was working on this piece about virtual reality for a very, very long time. And so in researching this, kind of witnessed many panels of people. It's hot in this area, right? For some reason, it's Sundance every year. And one of the questions I heard over and over was, when is the first time you tried VR? Which I found was odd. No one asks, what's the first like book you read to a novelist? But they still ask this because I think no one knows what to do with this whole newfangled VR thing. And I want to scream from the audience that the first time you tried VR is when you first time you opened your eyes, right? Like we are continually generating this kind of imaginative version of the world every time we close our eyes. And what if we could make that just a little bit more fun? Little things like that. And that's to me, I'm sure I am failing spectacularly to be imaginative in what could happen if you connected various different things.
So when you're talking about that idea of being able to sort of full colorize your imagination or something like that, it occurs to me that the way that I've experienced that phenomenon you're talking about in life is food. The sense of taste is one that if we had a bowl of strawberries here and I ate one, I am not necessarily tasting the strawberry that I'm currently eating. I'm sort of creating an amalgam of every strawberry I've ever eaten and have stopped kind of really tasting strawberries after all this time. So there's these things like they have restaurants where you eat in the dark, and so you can't create or contemporary food sometimes changes that they turn things into a foam so that a flavor becomes really new. Change a texture so that you retaste a flavor as if for the first time again, which reminds me of your idea that you could, you know, full colorize your imagination, that the picture inside your brain could be as vivid as the one that we're seeing when our eyes are open. I also wonder, I think people also think about your experience as from like if we're going to use filmmaking terms, that my perspective on the world is a single first-person perspective shot of the world all the time. But as I understand it, that's not exactly how our brains work, that I'm here from inside my head, my eyeballs are looking out and they see an image, but there's also, I also have a sense of you and I in this space. And if we wanted to go back to filmmaking terms, like I have a sense of the two shot. I've got a wide shot of us kind of understanding in my brain somehow.
In Trondheim, Norway, there's a like a rotating restaurant. It's like it's an old television tower, and it's got a restaurant at the top. And what's odd about it is the inner ring, which has the bathrooms, rotates at a different speed than the outer ring. And if you're eating in the outer ring, you go to the bathroom, you come back. It is one of the most disorienting things that a human brain can experience. And I actually think, I don't know if there's a definition for it, but it is an illusion, and it feels. It feels almost like the negative of déjà vu. It's like, I've been here, but I don't recognize it anymore. And the reason you don't recognize it is because your brain is, again, most of it's happening without your awareness, spending all of its energy. Like, we have to eat a lot of calories to keep up this temperature and keep our brain running, right? And mostly what it's doing is mapping out your immediate environment. And it's keeping track of all the paintings on the walls, and it's keeping track of this table and everything. And it's using that information in order to plan those movements that it's preparing, and most of them go nowhere. But you are continually making this scene, and we are just learning about, like, there's a recent Nobel Prize given to a husband and wife then team who figured out that brains are continually keeping track of every single wall and your location with respect to every single one of those walls. And there is a whole section of your brain whose job is just keeping track of your physical environment and locations and all the walls in it. And so part of, I think, what we feel as the almost like unfair richness of our ability to walk through our memories in the past, it's pretty neat. It's low fidelity, it's 80s Atari video game, but it's pretty neat that I can like walk through a childhood home or a childhood street right now if I want in my head. And I can do so at any angle. And part of the reason I can is because we're not just seeing it from this point of view. We are creating, and this is what I meant by your first experience with VR was when you opened your eyes. We're creating this kind of virtual representation of everywhere we are in our brain all the time.
Yeah. So what you're saying is we're using our brain to create or be aware of where the walls are in the space around us. But this restaurant in Norway that you're describing, I think it points out a flaw or a fact about what our brains are really doing, which is it's not that we're necessarily aware of exactly where the walls are. It's we're creating an impression of where we think they should be based on, I'm sitting here facing you. I don't know what the corner of this room is behind me. Conceivably, it could have moved without my knowing. I haven't turned around and looked at it. But in my experience as a human, in my understanding of the world that my brain creates all the time, I imagine I'm actively using energy to imagine that those walls are there and they come together in a corner behind me.
Oh, yeah. You're filling it in and it feels like a coherent story. And that coherent story is the same thing that's happening in that teenage girl's brain when she is filling in a reason for why she laughed. We have a ton of blank spots where a third of our visual scene is black, you know, when we're blinking or saccading, and the brain fills it in. And so you're filling in, the brain is a story machine. It is very good at making you feel like you're not moving your eyes three times a second. It's very good at making you feel like your brain is not heavy and sitting expensively using up all of your calories. It's very good at taking all of the little bits and pieces of your memories and collapsing them into the thing that you think of as your identity and self, right? And it kind of skips over all the gaps and all of that, and you're just you. But it's the same mechanism is kicking in each of those things to create this story of who you are. And so that's what I meant. Like, if you have a mind reading technology and you use it on the guard in the back of the bank vault who's daydreaming about robbing the bank, like, to get an accurate impression of that thought, to get what that thought really means, you have to also kind of have his whole story. Do you get the, you know, if I could read your thoughts right now, do I care about how you're coming up with the virtual corner behind you? You know, does that part of it, how do I disentangle that part? And so I think the overall thing I've noticed when I hear people talk about mind reading, when I see art that engages in mind reading, is that it fails, like anything outside of Virginia Woolf fails to appreciate how chaotic and weird thoughts actually are.
When we're talking about this technology of maybe like injectable nano dust, little tiny robots in our brains, a receiver, transmitter, helmet situation, is that going to be expensive? Is it going to be common? Is it going to turn into like a patch you could put on your arm? Is it going to be like regular people are going to use it? Is it going to be saved for, I don't know.
Okay, so in the new Blade Runner 2049, mm-hmm. right, there's a little port in the side of, I think, Jared's neck, right? Mm-hmm. In Existence, the old Cronenberg film, there's a port in the spine. These filmmakers were not wrong. Right now, if you look at people that are the experimental individuals, and I say experimental in the best possible way, which is to say people that are, say, paralyzed and are doing the work at academic kind of hospitals or hospitals to read their thoughts and read out like a robot arm, to be able to move a robot arm. These people, they have ports in their heads. They have ports in their skulls. So you drill a hole in the skull and you basically put a little copper lead there, and it's you close it off with a hermetically sealed cap, and then whenever you need to access the brain, you open it up. And so that is both how sci-fi envisioned this, because you have to get in somehow, and currently state of the art, just a port. It's not implausible that we will all have such a thing at some point. It's the best and easiest, most practical way of getting into the brain is you have to make a small hole. There's no other way in. The only other way in is through the blood. And it's possible that we'll be able to kind of like import from nature. There's a few things that can get into the brain. That parasite that I actually studied gets into brains, gets into human brains, gets into mouse brains via its bloodstream. So it is possible to get in that way. All right. So I can't tell if this is what I want to happen or what I think will actually happen, but I think at some point we will have, so the 1990s was the decade of the brain, but at some point I think we'll have a decade of sleep. I think the 2020s will be the decade of sleep where we realize that most of the modern world has a sleep disorder. And so I think if I have to like navigate the commercial applications of how this technology will pop and appear and become more normal, it will start with like a diagnosis. And I don't think it'll be an entertainment device. It's possible it'll be used for typing. That's kind of my dystopia. My dystopia is just boring. That's the future I fear the most.
Well, that doesn't sound too bad then.
Yeah.
If no, that's the worst case scenario.
and I think people might have like a sleep cap, something that they wear every night. You know, they have an injectable. We still don't know at that point in the 2020s, when I think the decade of sleep will happen, we still don't know how the brain works. We're still in the Babylonian era. But all we want to do is get more data and get more recordings. And we do that as people sleep.
In your history, sort of with philosophy also, is there, maybe this isn't the same, what you're talking about seems so literal, but I know a lot of people talk about meditation or transcendental meditation. Would that kind of serve the same purpose?
I think there are ways, insofar as stress, anxiety, certain things that whatever your kind of mental programmatic thing you do to relax, whatever that is, if it can reduce stress, if it can reduce anxiety, if it can kind of like keep you as a person operating at a more stable level, yes, it will be good for long-term health of the long-term metabolic health of the cells. But I guess I mean more, one of the more difficult things to realize is that like brains are just physical things that degrade over time, because they don't feel that way to us, and we don't almost want to on a like a spiritual level think about them that way. But they just kind of fall apart, and like all the other parts of our body. And so, yeah, I think we need to think of them as we do our teeth, or as we do other things and parts of our body that we have to maintain and keep up.
Would that technology be accessible to regular people? Would I be able to get one of these brain flossing machines? Or is it like you're talking about the experimental people right now who have the ports in their brains? Is installing the port what's massively expensive or prohibitive? Or is it the kind of treatment, what you put in there, or the measuring what comes out of there? Is there something like keeping this from being sort of like a mass produced, aside from functionality?
I imagine it'll start expensive. It'll start medical. The Secret Service will have it. The Navy SEALs will have little chips so that they don't have to use their voice when they communicate. Like right now, so if you have to dive underwater, you have to learn hand signals, right? Because you have poor communication. If you had these communication devices instead, a little chip in the back of your brain that knew what you were trying to sub-vocalize, you could imagine divers wanting it so that they wouldn't have to do the hand signal thing.
Or I imagine it becomes a consumer product once there's it feels like there's a commercial use for it. Once there's like if you could market it as a way to clean the plaque from your brain.
Absolutely. That's my decade of sleep marketing.
I love it. I think it's genius. I want to clean the plaque from my brain right now.
But even the brain flossing, you just trademarked that. Flossing.
Hashtag brain flossing. So I guess I also just wonder, is there a way that you could unwittingly implant one of these in someone else? And also, is there a way to either shut yours off or limit it to a single person or a single other receiver? Would we be able to have that level of control that we could either administer it to someone else without their consent, or that we could control who receives our, you know?
We already talk about people as if they're hackable. We already have either, I don't think this is just like a linguistic kind of accident. How much more hackable will we be, or how much more will our preferences be not in our control? really just to have an idea that like a physical thing could jump into your brain and change your preferences around. But this is why I wanted to study that parasite, because that's a physical thing that jumps in your brain that changes your preferences around. I don't think it's wrong, because brains are physical, to say a belief system that you grew up with is a physical thing that jumped into your brain and changes your preferences. And so I respect the concern and question about, like, is there going to be a sea change when this is finally a technology that's consumer? And will you be able to control, like, do you get a little iPhone app, you know, like you can control who hears what when kind of thing? I just mostly want to sit back and watch the transition from how we think about these things already. And I feel like we don't appreciate the fact that we already don't give ourselves enough credit. We already talk about a voter as if they are just nothing other than the accumulation of things that they've heard.
Yeah, that seems to make sense in terms of your interpretation of this as an extension of who and what we already are.
Hypothetical is a production of Film Nation Entertainment in association with Transmitter Media. It's distributed by Realm. The series was created by Milan Popelka and is executive produced by Greta Cohn and Milan Popelka. It's produced by Caitlin Pierce and Michaela Salella, with Oluwakemi Aladisui, and with help from Todd Whitney. This bonus interview was edited by Tori Smith, with additional editing from Alyssa Martino. Music by Dara Hirsch. Special thanks to Dr. Patrick House and the Science and Entertainment Exchange for connecting us with brilliant scientists like him. Additional thanks to Allison Cohen from Film Nation Entertainment.
Hey there, it's Rachel Ballinger, and I am extremely excited to invite you to Rachel Uncensored. It's my podcast where I sit down and get real with my friends and celebrity guests, where we talk about all sorts of topics. And sometimes we might be under the influence when we do so. We cover things from personal stories to hot button issues. And it's the only place on the internet you can find an uncensored version of me. It's a side of me that you might not have seen before, because it's not the most family or brand friendly. But don't worry, I'm still sort of slightly a decent human being. If you're intrigued, then make sure you check it out. New episodes drop every Wednesday. You can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Trust me, you won't want to miss out on the fun and candid conversations we have here on Rachel Uncensored.